Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This is God's word.
May the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So you showed up for Persecution Sunday. Aren't you glad? Yeah. This text is a great example of why I think it's good to pick portions or sometimes even books of the Bible. This year's been a little bit different, kind of bouncing around wisdom literature, but moments like this remind you that there's parts of the Bible that you might not teach. And some people would teach about persecution every single week because they think it's cool. And those people need to go to counseling. I would not. It is not the thing that's on my mind all the time. And so when I come up to a text like this, I look at it and go, oh, I probably need to wrestle with this and think about it because Jesus taught about it. And therefore, it might be more important than I tend to realize. And speaking of wrestling with things, that's the point of wisdom literature, which we're doing for the year. It's meant to instigate thought and wrestling. We've been saying that throughout the year, the hard candy metaphor of literature, which is meant to be contemplated, dealt with slowly and methodically, paying attention to all of the different facets and flavors that are there. And wisdom literature sometimes puts out something that doesn't, it's not maybe a thorough explanation of a topic. It can feel really short. Sometimes wisdom literature comes in the form of something like a contradiction or a pronouncement that on the surface feels too clean cut. And it's meant to struggle with, and it's meant to deal with and to say, isn't there more to this? Isn't this more complicated than it seems? And that's precisely the process you're supposed to go through. So as we've been in the church calendar, sort of in the church calendar, we've taken the Easter season to listen to the wisdom sayings of Jesus and the Beatitudes. And this is the final part of the Beatitudes today. The next week, we'll be back to Proverbs for a while during ordinary time. So a Beatitude, just by way of reminder, is a statement framed as a blessing to come and combined with a woe for those who oppose the ideal in the Beatitude. So today, the blessing is, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And it's coupled with a woe that comes in the in the back end of Matthew 23. And in fact, we read the first half of this last week, and the second half is especially applicable today, but I'm going to read the whole thing. So this is the flip side of the Beatitude. What sorrow awaits you, teachers of the religious law and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build tombs for the prophets and your ancestors that your ancestors killed, and you decorate the monuments of the godly people your ancestors destroyed. Then you say, if we'd lived in those days, we would not have joined them in killing the prophets. And saying that, you testify against yourselves that you are indeed the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Go ahead and finish what your ancestors started, you snakes, sons of vipers. How will you escape the judgment of hell? And we talked about that last week as it was also tied to blessed are the peacemakers. It's kind of the flip side of that. And then here it goes on to be even more connected to what we read tonight. Jesus says, therefore, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and teachers of religious law, which is meaning his disciples and those who will follow after them, an alternative community, if you will. But you will kill some by crucifixion, and you will flog others with whips in your synagogues, chasing them from city to city. As a result, you'll be held responsible for the murder of all godly people of all time. From the murderer of righteous Abel, that's the first murder in the Bible, to the murder of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you killed in the temple between the sanctuary and the altar, which is this unthinkable act of murder within the temple. Jesus says, I tell you the truth, this judgment will fall on this very generation. That's heavy, right? So this beatitude also signals the completion of the Beatitudes through what you call an inclusio. The first beatitude ends with, theirs will be the kingdom of heaven, and so does this one. So this is marking kind of the completion of the Beatitudes. And then there's another portion. Some think it's a bit of an addendum. Others think it's a unique additional beatitude. It says this, blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And it kind of combines the beatitude and the woe and puts it more in the positive. So, and it emphasizes reward, okay? So some people say, one of the commentators I read says, this particular beatitude is like the culmination and the test of all of the other ones. That if this one you can embody, the other ones are true for you. This is like the test. And I was thinking about that idea of a test, and I thought about a diamond and how, like, you know, the diamond is a very hard substance, right? And you can test it because there are other stones that look like a diamond. They appear like a diamond. So you can see a ring and you might think, I don't know. Cubic zirconia, diamond, I don't know. And there are ways to test it, right? You could put it under pressure. You can mar it. You could scratch at it. There's old tests. I'm very glad Garrett isn't here because I was thinking Garrett's going to know what all the tests are. Just he always knows all the things, but he's not here, so I don't have to deal with that. But you take the diamond and you apply the test and you can find out if you have a real diamond. So is the character of the true disciple as revealed in this intense beatitude, right? That even under persecution, they will rejoice and be glad. Then you know. You really know. So the beatitude we're looking at and wrestling with today, we're going to look at it four different ways. Why it scares us, why people like me don't want to talk about it, what persecution even is, where it comes from, and how could we flourish in the face of it? How could we rejoice and be glad? I think that sounds really difficult to do, right? So why does it scare us? I have an easy answer for this. You ready? Because it's really scary. Persecution's scary. Here's my evidence for this. Jesus. This is the one who says he was with God at the creation of the world, and he's entered in on a mission to save people. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when he's about to get arrested, and it's about to go down, and he's about to take on this punishment that we kind of talked about with the kids briefly, he begs his father, mysteriously, because it's Trinity Sunday, himself, sort of, right? He begs God, though he is in very nature God, could I please not do this? Jesus, who knows what is about to happen, and he knows the end result of it all, he still looks at the pain of suffering and says, please, is there any other way? And that means to me that I get to be scared of persecution, okay? That says to me that it is a gut-wrenching thing to face. And in fact, I'm glad I don't have the kind of information that Jesus has, knowing my future and what's going to happen to me, because I don't know if I could handle that. I don't know if I could handle knowing the hard things that are going to happen to me, even if they're not persecution. Okay. Everybody I read preparing for this sermon made a similar caveat at the beginning of their persecution chapter. And almost all of them said something like this. If you kind of want persecution, there's something wrong. And they said there's a type of person that seeks it out and kind of feeds off it. And that type of person isn't even relating to Jesus, because Jesus didn't feed off of persecution. He didn't go looking for persecution. He was willing to suffer. And he was faithful to redeem us and enter in. But it wasn't because he was into it. It wasn't because it was a really cool way to go down in history. That's not what it was. And when you think it's cool, it's actually about you, which actually puts it outside of the category of persecution and into a different category altogether, which we'll discuss. Okay? So that you don't want to do that. I also worry, though, about those of us who don't want to talk about it at all. Honestly, my natural bent. Because Jesus says, and it's throughout the story of the Bible, that it could be part of the cost of discipleship. It could be. And you can read stories. You can read Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book, The Cost of Discipleship, and then look at the life he ends up having to live and the choices he has to make. It could come up. And you need to know that. You need to take that seriously, because Jesus has taught us to count the cost of following him. It's a cost. There's a potential high cost. And it's worrisome if you're not factoring in that possibility. You should. You should be able to say that I would follow Jesus even if it costs me everything. Even if it terrifies you, you should be willing. Okay? Before we go any further, though, I want to get a little more fine-tuned on this idea of persecution. The word, the Greek word for this, is to be hunted or to hunt. To persecute is to hunt down. It's a pretty dark word. So when are you going through persecution as a Christian? This is my question to the audience here. In the spirit of wisdom literature, I'd love to hear some of your thoughts. When are you going through it as a Christian? It's being hunted. What do you think? What kind of things would be happening to you? A clog in the toilet? Becky? When Satan is in pursuit. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's good. Like, there's a spiritual hunt. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Conversations about the family.
Explain.
Just like the nuclear family.
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. What that's going to, how you might diverge from the family or things like that. Is that what you mean? Potentially? Okay. Peter?
If it's, you know, take out, like, the things, stupid things I do that would cause people not like me. That has nothing to do with being a Christian. It has to be specifically because I'm obeying Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not, yeah, I'm to quote Peter, it's not because I'm being a dum-dum. Yeah, it's because of following Jesus specifically. Louis, what would you add?
I'd go to bullying.
Being bullied, sure.
Yeah.
I'd like to suggest some misconceptions, and you've hinted at them. Persecution is not when people respond to your aggression or criticism by matching your energy. So if you criticize somebody, you're wrong, and they come back at you, no, you're wrong. That's not persecution. They've just matched your energy. Persecution is not, kind of to Peter's point, when people don't like you because you're annoying. Or a dum-dum. No. Actually, you know what? I'm going to say if they don't like you because you're a dum-dum, that's worse than if you're. But if it's just because it's a personality issue or it's choices, like you're not being wise in how you communicate, right? That's not persecution. That's somebody responding to you. Persecution as a Christian, which is my question specifically, is not the same as being persecuted for a cause. That could be persecution, but you could be persecuted for, you know, all sorts of things. You could get hunted down for your views on all sorts of things, right? You could stand up for something, but it might not be Jesus. And while that might get into what the word means, it wouldn't be being persecuted as a Christian. And sometimes that gets kind of mixed up. Like, what am I being, you know, disagreed with about? Persecution is also not when life's hard. Because we go through a lot of trials, many struggles for many reasons, but it is not persecution on Jesus's account that I don't have as much money as I wish I had to fix my house. That's not persecution. And even if somebody should pay me more, it's not persecution. Okay? So that's some of the misconceptions. What it is, we can deduce even from the Beatitude, let's go into it. Jesus said, blessed. Now, if you remember from past weeks, that word, some translators want to say it means happy. Happy are the persecuted. Eugene Peterson wants to say he really liked the word lucky because he felt like there was this, in the original, there's this sense of like joy. So he knew lucky was too problematic because it sounds like, you know, secular or whatever. But he said it had the same oomph as blessed. Lucky. Lucky you. You're being persecuted, right? Doesn't that sound about right? Daniel Daly, who I've referred to several times, who wrote the book Ideal Disciples, likes the word flourishing because blessed feels like something that's just sort of bestowed on you. But he makes the point that the word for blessed is actually like living into a blessing. And so he likes the word flourishing. But whatever the case it is, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Righteousness' sake. Okay? So then we have to kind of wonder in the book of Matthew, what does Jesus' righteousness look like in the book of Matthew? Because that's where we are. So if it's the sake of righteousness and Jesus embodies righteousness, what does it look like in the book of Matthew? Well, it's pretty core to the book of Matthew that it is God's will and plan for his people through Jesus as a savior figure promised beforehand that the people of God would be a people who were redeemed and expanded out into the nations and groups of people that the Jewish community of this day kind of gives the side eye. Why do I say that? The word expansion there is something we see throughout the book of Matthew because Matthew, our author, is an expansion of the concept of the kingdom of God himself. One of the famous moments in the book of Matthew that is very key to what he understands is going on with Jesus is that when he, a tax collector, so he's a betrayer of his people in a way, he's in collusion with the Roman government, he's been doing it to get more money, he's been taking advantage of his fellow countrymen, and he is an outcast. The Pharisees, religious leaders, Sadducees for that matter, who are, you know, these are different kind of religious and political groups, they want nothing to do with Matthew. And Jesus sees Matthew and he says, follow me. And Jesus then takes Matthew up on his invitation to come over to his house, which is full of people like Matthew. It says tax collectors and sinners, which you could interpret pretty broadly, but this is people who are not living up to the standards of the people of Israel. And Jesus goes and he dines with them, and the religious leaders, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, as this picture from the Brooklyn Art Museum depicts, are critical of that. He's engaging not only with Gentiles, people of other nations, but with the crooked failures of their time. And Matthew sees this as the mission of Jesus and part of what we would call his righteousness. It's not just an inward legal state. It's the life that Jesus lives. Righteousness is always evidenced in the life that we live. Jesus' righteousness is evidenced in how he lives, including his mission. It was a righteous mission of his to seek to redeem lost and discarded and failed people, to make the good news accessible to people outside of Judaism of the day, which is, by the way, why you are here. Because this thing got expanded out. Okay? So to be persecuted for righteousness' sake is to follow Jesus in the ministry he exhibited to his disciples and then to continue that righteous ministry. Which is that, you know, that ministry caused some to be won over, and it offended and turned away others. It turned away people who were feeling like purity was the most important question, that their future and their comfort and the state of their religion was the most important question. So they persecuted anybody who disrupted that. Okay? In the second portion, Jesus adds, "Blessed are you when people revile you and utter falsehoods about you." So if someone says that, you know, that Christian, Joey, that Christian, Joey, I'm trying to wake you up, Joey. I'm trying so hard, Joey. No, okay. That Christian offends me because he's a jerk. And if you are a jerk, that's not persecution, right? But if they say you're a jerk because you were following Jesus, then that could be persecution. Because Jesus adds, on my account, which clarifies it's not any political objective. It's not on the account of being a part of a religious group that is distinct. So if like Mission Church got a really bad rap out there and you were like, no, I'm with Mission Church. Mission Church is the best. That's not what it is. It's about being connected to Jesus specifically. Okay? We talked last week about the peacemakers, and Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. And then we talked about the Garden of Gethsemane and how he commanded his disciples that they could not use a sword. And we talked about, this is confusing. His kingdom is bringing a sword, but his disciples can't use a sword. And we saw that what Jesus was saying was that the sword that is going to be brought is going to be against you. You don't bear the sword. It'll be against you. You'll face it. Here's Daniel Daly, his book. He goes on to note that in Matthew, the persecution idea is constant and unavoidable, and it's in fact a theme of the entire Bible, but it's always used for when people are innocent of what they're being criticized of. So when Jesus dines with tax collectors and sinners later, he will be exhibiting this beatitude because the people will accuse him of being a glutton and a drunkard because he hangs out with them. He's not. Okay? That's the key. He's not. He's with gluttons and drunkards, but he's not one. It's a false accusation. So when he says they will malign you, he exhibits this. He goes around people that will get you maligned, but he is mischaracterized when he is maligned. So that's essentially what persecution for being a Christian is. It's identifying with Jesus, following Jesus on his mission, and then being maligned like Jesus when you do that by people that don't like the mission of Jesus. Okay? So where does this idea of persecution come from? I want to attempt a thought experiment here in which you do your best to get in the head of a persecutor. Why does somebody persecute somebody else? What are they trying to achieve? What does someone who persecutes try to achieve? What do you think, Shua?
Change their behavior.
Change their behavior. Yeah. Yeah. Cassie.
Validate their own opinions or standing.
Yeah, to validate their own opinions or standing. Sure. Absolutely. Temet. Wipe out what they disagree with. Get a bad thing out, right? Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that?
If somebody is doing the right thing calling Jesus, they make somebody else feel guilty, that it shows they're not doing that. They try and make that person look bad to make themselves feel better.
Yes. When you're dealing with guilt inside, you like to project guilt on another person, right? Like there's something within us that does that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so undoubtedly there's the darkened soul out there. Like, I mean, this is, you know, Batman stuff, you know, where they just want to see the world burn. There's the Jokers of the world. There's probably a few of those out there. But for almost everybody else, the motive is somewhat understandable, right? Like everything you all said is like understandable. There's a way of being or thinking that somebody believes is actually a problem for society. And they think if we hunt down the founder or the loyalists, we can get rid of this thing that's destroying everybody, right? That's usually the idea. It's usually positive. Missy in our meeting this week, talking about the sermon, talked about how persecution could occur when a good thing goes too far. And she used the example of a relationship can move too far into abuse in one direction or another, even if that wasn't originally the intention. Authority is good, but exerting too much authority is abusive. Even that begins with a decent premise. Lonnie brought up that, you know, in the case of murder, which is often tied to persecution, Jesus teaches later in the Sermon on the Mount that if you think murderous thoughts, right? And then Jesus goes on from that and even says, even if you call somebody a fool in your heart, you're guilty of the sin that underlies murder. So Lonnie said, wouldn't it be true of persecution that the mind that thinks about wanting people gone, you know, could have the seed that leads to persecution laying right there inside their own heart? Isn't that possible? I think it is. Which means that it's not just that the like wild, weird, and crazy people are potentially persecutors. It means I could be. I could be. This is true of almost all belief systems, right? Hostilities are bound to arise due to our differences. They're right underneath the surface. You know, Lord of the Flies there's a new version on Netflix. I've only watched the first one. I was trying to get it all done before this sermon, but Michaela blocked me because I'm not allowed to watch things without her. So we only got one down. So she was like, no, you cannot do that. Oh, sorry. Yeah, everybody's agreeing. Look, it's fine. That's fine. It really is. But I've seen the original and I've read the book. Okay, so the original Lord of the Flies set as an event that happened during the Second World War and reflecting back on the Second World War. There are these nice boys, pretty nice boys, little British boys on a plane, and they crash. The first episode that I can actually speak to of the new season has a pretty powerful scene where there's just the singing of the Kyrie, of Lord have mercy, right? And it's just this beautiful, harmonious singing. And these are boys who have grown up in a society that's shaped around Christian values. They're raised in the church. That's what the story is telling us, right? And they're on an island together. And all of a sudden, all those restraints that were on them, when they try to start governing themselves, quickly devolve. And they become, like, inhumane, right? Why is that? Why did the filmmakers of this story still see this as a story that needs to be told? Thank you. There you go, Roland. Roland is saying ban books. Okay. Roland, the whole talk back thing here was actually over a little. No. why are they telling this story? Because it's obvious when you look out at our world, at our society, that humans are susceptible to evils and self-centered behavior and can actually devolve toward the demonic and the inhumane. We see it all the time. Does anybody know what the name Lord of the Flies is a translation of? Oh, yeah. What is it?
Beelzebub.
That's right. Beelzebub. Here's a Milton illustration from Milton's Paradise Lost. There's a lot of weird illustrations of Beelzebub out there. Beelzebub in the Bible is the enemy of Israel, the Philistines' god, their deity. Except here's what we think happened here. We don't think the Philistines called their god Beelzebub, the Lord of the Flies. We think they called their god the Lord of the High Place, the Lord Most High, something like that. But because the Philistines were bloodthirsty and they killed people, and that's what the flies are attracted to, the Israelites gave their god a new name, Lord of the Flies. And they kind of said, your god leads you to do this. And so we think Beelzebub is their renaming of the Philistine god. So what the Lord of the Flies is trying to teach is that all humanity, even sweet little British schoolboys who sing the Kyrie, can devolve into being Philistines when the structures are taken off of them and when they're left to fend for themselves. We need to know, that story is telling us, that we could deform as well. We're all capable of this. That story is trying to explain what happened behind the Second World War. It's not really about little boys. It's about grown men and societies. So oddly, the persecuted need to understand how close they are to being persecutors in order to stop the cycle. One thing that is evident in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, but it's all across the Bible, is that often the persecutors are coming out of God's people. Not always, but often. This isn't to diminish the persecution of the Philistines or the persecution that would break out by Rome against the church, but those are kind of secondary and they don't get as much of a hard word as what Jesus brings down on these people, right? Because Jesus references the ways that persecution is broken out of his people, his chosen family. What's the first one? Cain killing Abel. It's the son of Adam and Eve, right? One generation from face to face with God. And that's what's happening. And then he talks about this atrocious killing that he calls persecution that happens by the priests in the middle of the temple, which should be unthinkable. Absolutely unthinkable. And then Jesus says, the peacemakers that I am going to send to you, my disciples, you're going to do the same thing to them. You're going to beat them right in the middle of the synagogue where you teach the word. Right there. Now, persecution can feel like old news, right? To Americans, Yeah, I mean, we know there's some weird stuff that goes on. We know that other countries have some stuff. Look, maybe even in some backwoods cult, right, there's persecution going on. I actually think that, like, the version we're most attuned to right now is actually in the back halls of power. Why do we like the Bourne trilogy? I love the Bourne trilogy. Why do we love this movie? Because we're pretty sure there's government operatives. Look, you know, you think about it. I see a lot of chuckles. Yeah, like taking people out. It's just quiet, right? I mean, that's why we love hate these films. I'd like to submit, though, that we even have much more sanitary means for stomping on movements today, right? In our society, killing someone, unless you're Jason Bourne, comes at great inconvenience. I would highly recommend you not kill anybody. It will be very inconvenient for you, right? In Jesus's time, less inconvenient. You could get away with stuff. Sometimes the martial law thing was kind of just in effect. Today, very inconvenient. But look, I had a favorite restaurant that got shut down for political beliefs. They were very unwise in how they communicated their political beliefs. They were foolish. But they got shut down, like, in a couple weeks. If someone's suspected of being on the wrong side of an issue today, there's the doxing, right? Leaking your documents. It happens. There's a goal of silence. We had a professor at Missional Training Center that had been doxed. He and his family had been threatened over and over because their address and phone number had been leaked. And it's because he wrote a book about the history of slavery in the American church. And it was factual, it was just academic, and that's the problem. It was done well. So he got shut down. Nobody did the things they said they were going to do to him yet. Yeah, but it's easy to shut him down because it's not worth it for him to lose the life of his family. Now, that sounds wrong when you hear it, right? Like, I doubt any of you have ever gone out of your way to tell somebody you're going to kill them. But I will tell you that it's very common, very common. He said so. I've heard it from other people I know and other credible voices that it's common that the people that send the death threats are known Christians. That's common. See, Christians have been doing this for a long time. I think we taught our culture how to cancel, actually. I remember a long time ago, and I still wrestle with this, Dungeons and Dragons. I'm still scared of playing it. Because I was told all these devil stories and how all those people were really bad people. And so those of you who play it, cruise, freaking me out, man. People that wore Mossimo shirts when I was a kid, right? Those had the sign of the beast in them. People who drank at Starbucks, remember that? Remember when the church was real anti-Starbucks and Target, right? Yeah. And if you happen to have a social media algorithm at all like mine that feeds you ministry stuff, do you know what I see all the time? Is Christians who seems like their favorite sport is taking down other Christians in front of the whole stinking world. Just tearing them to shreds. Wow. Mike brought up a good point at our meeting. He said, when you see the person you disagree with getting doxxed or canceled or, you know, blown up publicly, and you say in your heart, well, I wouldn't do that, but it's honestly probably for the best that they did it to them. Maybe that means you have that seed of the persecutor within you. And that is convicting to me, right? I hate it when it's done to my people, but when it's the other people, I go, well, you know, I'm uncomfortable with doing that myself, but it's probably for the best. So where does persecution come from? It comes from that same self-centered, satanic spirit that led to the first murder that got all the way into the temple courts and the priests of God's chosen people. It's not just something that comes from these really terrible outsiders who don't claim to follow God. It often comes from those closest, and it might be closer to us than we think. It's something to consider. Okay? I had a goal. I'm going to tell you my goal just to make sure it happens. All right? I had an assumption that most of us think persecution is something I would never do. I would never want to be any part of it. And my goal today is for you to realize that you actually might be an accessory to it now. Because it's okay with you that it happens to other people. So, it happens. So how in the world would you flourish, be happy, or be lucky in the face of persecution, right? Yeah. First, I'll note, for me, and I mentioned this to our team that was gathered together, that whole thing of, you know, Christians blowing each other up on social media, I kid you not, I'm just going to admit to you one of my biggest struggles as a believer, and it's not with you, it's not with those people, it's with God. I have a hard time dealing with the fact that the Spirit of God lets that go on. It seriously discourages me so much. It's one of the things that kind of like pummels my faith, is seeing God's people hate each other. And so I took a little solace this week thinking about this in this one fact. At least Jesus told us ahead of time that that kind of thing would happen. Because that at least means to me that though it's not okay and it's not good, that Jesus isn't just up there wringing his hands going, oh no, they're out of control down there. At least he knew it would happen. So that still doesn't answer how do we face it? How do we flourish in the face of it? How do we face persecution? I mean, if it's blessed are, flourishing are, and you're supposed to actually like sign up for that and count the cost, what does that mean? I think it means simply this. Be the kind of person that follows Jesus. I think it's that simple. Jesus, see, he wasn't motivated by being rejected. I don't think Jesus looked down and was like, that'd be a gnarly story to tell if I just got beat to a pulp by the priests and I went to a cross and everybody would read about it and they'd put me on a necklace and I would be a really big flippin' deal. I don't think Jesus did any of that. I think he was motivated by a couple things. Number one, faithfulness to his Father who called him to that mission, and love for those who he came to save. And he was willing to suffer for that cause. He was willing to do what he had to do. And if we are to be hunted down, it should be because, not because we want to be, but because we want to be faithful to our Father in heaven, and we love other people. And if somebody's going to hate us for that, so be it. I think it's that simple. And then how can we be glad? How can you be glad? Well, Jesus gives an answer, and he says the reward will be great. Great is your reward. So don't you want to know what the reward is? It's money. Never mind. That can't be right. Doesn't the idea of a reward make you nervous? There's something about, like, we're saved by grace, like, the glory of God, and something about like reward makes me nervous. And I think that's because when we want to get rewards, it's not for the best reasons. But actually, the theme of reward is all throughout Matthew. So what might it be? And I want to propose that the reward we get is what we want the most. I once won the candy bar selling contest of Casas Adobe's Baptist School. I won the whole stinking thing. I was the top candy bar seller, okay? And I won myself a red Huffy mountain bike. Or no, it was like a freestyle bike. And I know why I won it. I can tell you why. I think I was the only kid in that school, and that was my only path to getting a bike like that. I think every other kid had a path. I think mom and dad could buy him a bike like that, maybe a better one. For me, when I saw that bike, I was like, I have one way to get this bike. So when I stood outside of Fry's Food and Drug with my candy bars, I was on it. And I sold those things like crazy, right? And I got what I wanted. I got what I wanted. I was motivated. Okay, if the prophets that came before Jesus, and Jesus is the greatest of them all, if they wanted to please God, and if they wanted to bring the message of God, the love of God, the redemption of the story of God to other people, then the reward at its greatest would be to enjoy that, right? To know God more, to see those people in his kingdom. That would be the greatest thing you could get. It's what you wanted. Jesus elsewhere talks about the Pharisees, and he says they get their reward too. And that's an interesting commentary on judgment. They wanted to be seen praying in the streets. And he says, they got it. That's what they'll get. I wonder what an eternity of being seen is like. I wonder what an eternity of thinking of yourself is like. I think the essence of this could be that the life lived for God and following Jesus is the best life possible because it actually fulfills our desires at the deepest level. We long to be known, loved, connected to. We want to live for a purpose. Our problem is that we shoot too low. Self-centeredness is only self-centeredness when self is the highest aim, right? When our self, myself, our communal self, seeks to find happiness in God and in loving others, it ceases to be selfish. It becomes creative, loving, and redeeming. It becomes worship, even though it's extremely good for us. It becomes our ultimate reward. I've been reading the book Evangelism in an Age of Despair. You may have heard me talk about it. It's dense. It's good. And I'm going to end the sermon with a metaphor from the book that Andrew Root has. And he talks about how evangelism works well when you consider yourself a pilgrim instead of a tourist. So, the tourist. The tourist thinks that they have everything that they need already. And their goal of traveling, and I'm about to do this, I'm about to be a tourist. Their goal in traveling, right, is to recreate, potentially to get some experiences, some products, and then to bring those back to where home is. And some live life that way, desiring in everything they do to find happiness and fulfillment, and then to get back to themselves at the core. Just bring it all back right here. Bring it back right here. I have everything I want is right here. I just need a little bit more for me. Root goes on to say that the pilgrim mentality when it comes to faith says, I haven't seen anything yet. There's more than I could ever imagine. There's where I'm coming from, and there's a place I long to see. There's what I know of God now, and there's the fullness of knowing God that I have not even tasted yet, right? And the pilgrim is walking in that direction. In Evangelism in an Age of Despair, Andrew Root is trying to tell people that the best way to do evangelism is to meet people in their sorrow, because the modern promise of happiness is failing. So he says, when you meet people in their sorrow and you tell them there's a God that can meet them in their sorrow, that's extremely good news to people, and they'll be very receptive. That's what he's saying. And he says that you can't do a very good job of that when you're a tourist. But when you're a pilgrim and you know that you and they haven't seen anything yet, that there's something better to come, that you can come side by side with someone who's suffering and take part in a ministry that looks like the cross, where you suffer with and for somebody, and you can do it wholeheartedly, believing that there is a resurrection that stands before and a reward that is great. And I think that example shows how we could be happy and blessed and flourishing in the face of even persecution. Knowing that all the lesser challenges and trials we face, if following Jesus costs us everything, knowing that the resurrection of Jesus is ahead of us and the darkness will not prevail. And then, when we believe that, when we lean into that, when we try that out, I think that we don't just go through hard times. I think we'll actually meet and know Jesus profoundly in the midst of those hard times. I think that these disciples who follow Jesus, that the rest of our Bible is about, I don't think when they went out and they suffered that they, you know, looked at their life and went, well, that was a waste. What a terrible life. It seems to me that their story is that they met and knew and communed with Jesus all the way home. And that's how a pilgrim thinks. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. As we move into our three final rhythms of worship, confess, receive, and offer, we're going to think about these things. Confession, there are a few things that that came up today. Sometimes I talk about how we confess faith and we can confess anything to Jesus, but a key thing we do confess is also our sin and our struggles. And I think there are a few ways we could go about this today. One would be thinking about, is that seed of persecution in me? Am I actually glad when other people are taken down and I don't have to do it? That's something we could look at. Another thing we could look at is, like, what am I really aiming for that makes me think that life is good and worth it? What's my reward? We could wrestle with that before God. This 2 minutes of silence is a time to do what wisdom literature invites us to do and wrestle with God on these topics. If you're at all like me, this didn't land with me as like, hey, no problem. It landed with me as something I need to keep thinking about. On the tail end of that, we receive. And as we come up here to the table, you'll notice when Mike gets up here to lead, people will line up right here and I'll serve the Lord's Supper. And we have a great moment to remember. Like, this is persecution here. Like, Jesus suffered at the hands of people. He was unjustly tried. He was unjustly killed. And blessed is he. I mean, happy. He did dread it, but he faced it knowing the goodness of God and the resurrection to come and loving us. Like, receive what he has done out of love. And then as you go off around the chairs, we have our offering area in the back. And I want you to really think about it. If you, this week, I just want you to think about the next 7 days, if you were to follow the mission of Jesus, no matter the result, what's one thing you would do different? And just write a word or phrase that reminds you of that back on that back window. If you were to follow Jesus, no matter the cost this week, identify with his mission, what one thing would you do different? And think about offering that to him. We have monetary offering back there. I am supposed to talk about it. Our financial year ends at the end of June. Please do contribute, but especially contribute your heart and souls to the mission of Jesus. I'm going to pray for us, and then we'll have 2 minutes of silence for confession. So let's pray. Father, this idea of persecution seems so far off until we really consider how quickly we can turn on each other. I was thinking about those Pharisees and teachers of the law, and I'm positive they believed they were doing what was best. That scares me. Because I feel like I'm doing the right thing a lot. Father, we need you to assess our hearts. We need you to teach us what love is. We need you to teach us what it means to be faithful to you. We need your heart toward those who are lost and struggling and broken. So please, grant that to us, that we could see from your perspective and really follow you. Not compromise anything, but follow you. And that seems like the lesson we're going to be learning our whole lives. So hold our hearts committed to that, no matter the cost. Lead us now as we pray.